Well, hello and welcome to what is a special edition of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Cassin-Redding.
And Julie Selwyn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that didn't go as well as I'd hoped. But we'll forge through. Professor Julie Selwyn.
Literally 90 seconds ago, Julie said her preference and you still forgot it. Come on, man. Pull yourself together. It's
job.
Almost like you're interviewing someone who's famous or something. I don't know. You know, I mean,
well, that is our point. I think I'm a little bit wobbly because I feel like I'm in sort of in special presence of someone like a notary within the adoption community. Julie, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit, give us a sort of a summary of the work that you've done? Because I think most people will know, but some people may not be that familiar with the kind of the breadth of work that you've done in relation to adoption and other stuff.
Well, maybe I should start with my background, because it's
yes, it's
has influenced everything I've done. So I started work in the 1970s in a huge children's home, which was 50 bedded, 10 boys each cottage that was round a big hall. And I was very young. I was 18. And I was suddenly in charge of this cottage with boys who were not that much younger than me and expected to work there. We wore uniforms. We had keys around our waists. Many of the boys had been since birth. The culture and the way you were expected to treat these children was something I'd never had any experience of, just growing up in an ordinary family. And I was shocked. There were no books. And I'd grown up in a family where my parents had instilled a love of books in us, you know, with comics and from a very...
Yeah.
So everything was very austere. And the matron who ran this children's home said, we have to make it like this so nobody else wants to put their children in care. And that was...
Ooh.
Yes, that was kind of prevailing view. So... I did work in residential care in other units for about 10 years and then qualified as a social worker and did all kinds of jobs, child protection, lots of different things, but finally ended up in an adoption team where I became the team manager. And I just saw what a difference adoption could make to children's lives. And I thought back to those children when I was only 18, and I didn't know anything at that point, really. Although, as we were talking earlier, Al, you think you know everything at 18. and you know, I never thought at 18 I couldn't do it. But, you know, I looked back and I thought, if only that opportunity had been available for those children, their lives would have been very different. Because, you know, I also knew, as I tracked many of... not tracked, but I knew what was happening to some of those children, that quite a few of them had committed suicide, they'd ended up in prison, and their adult lives were really sad. And I knew how much difference adoptions could make. So I qualified as a social worker, did, as I said, lots of jobs, and kind of serendipitously, ended up at the University of Bristol training social workers. And I was very lucky to be mentored by David Quinton, who you may not know about, but he used to work with Michael.
No.
And he was a terrific influence on me and taught me an awful lot about research. And the first real big study I led was something called Costs and Outcomes of Adoption. And that was tracking through all the children who'd been adopted in three local authorities who were over the age of five at the point they were adopted. And I read all their case files and then interviewed their carers to find out what had happened to them. And again, some of those case files, was such sad reading. Many of them had been, many of them had entered care, and this was before, this was about the time the Children Act was coming in, when the emphasis was on keeping children in care, back in their families, sorry. And many of these children had been returned home again and again and again, reused again and again and again, before finally coming into care and adoption recommendation being made. I interviewed many of those children, and I interviewed many of the families. In total, myself and the team did about 80 interviews, and from reading the case files, we were almost predicting which ones would have gone well and which wouldn't, depending on what had happened to them. And there was one boy in the who'd had probably, you know, some of the worst family background you can imagine, multiple sexual abuse, had been called the dog in his family. He'd had a dog bowl, treated very differently than all the other children in the family, before finally coming into care. He wasn't adopted until he was 9. And I expected this to be, you know, fairly disastrous. But I went to see the family, and it had been a tremendous success. And he came into the room, and he stamped on the table as I was interviewing his mum, his adoptive mum. And he said, "I want you to know this is the best thing that's ever happened to me." And he marched out again. And I thought, fantastic, you know. And it just showed me as a research, you know, just how much we have to learn about what we can predict and what we can't. And then from that study, I did various other small studies, but I then was very fortunate to get the DfE contract to look at adoption disruption. And at that time, the policymakers were thinking, we're not going to be able to do this. We won't be able to find adoptive parents who didn't talk to us about this. It's impossible. And in fact, I found the opposite. I had people complaining that they weren't part of the sample. You know, they really wanted to talk to me.
But I can imagine.
You know, but it was, again, it wasn't what we expected. You know, I went into it thinking what we are going to find is children who are having difficulties with attachment, difficulties, you know, relationship difficulties, maybe acting out in a sexually inappropriate way. And those were the things that were going to be really disturbing to parents, but it wasn't. You know, every time, there were three researchers on this study, by the way, not just me, but every time one of us had done an interview, we'd come back and we'd say, it's violence again, it's violence. And nobody had ever talked about violence that was going on in families. So we wrote a report about child-to-parent violence or adolescent-to-parent violence, whichever word you want to use. And it was like a complete shockwave that went off in not only the adoption community, but within policymakers and research as well, because it had been hidden for all these years. And nobody was talking about it.
Yeah.
It, you know, the consequence of that was the beginning of the Adoption Support Fund. And that is a fantastic thing to have achieved. You know, if you do anything in your life, you know, do you think that your research has led to the Adoption Support Fund? You know, that is fabulous. And people began to talk about it. So, you know, so now I get emails from Canada, from all over the world, with people saying, this is happening to us too, but nobody's talking about it in our country. What can we do? Sorry, that was a bit of a long-winded answer.
No, that's really interesting, actually, because I think that when I think about when I first became aware of Beyond the Adoption Order, it was published in 2015, wasn't it? Yeah, and I'd been with Adoption UK since October 2014. So when that came out, and then obviously the ASF come along, it kind of all bunched together in some in a way, not altogether. And just the fact that people were talking out loud about some of the negative sides of this, I think that from my perspective anyway, I think it instigated some conversations about the less positive sides of adoption as well, which actually is positive. Because, you know, the kind of general public always assumed that adoption was great and fantastic, and not realizing there was kind of undercurrents of things like you've mentioned, you know, CPV and, you know, parenting from a distance or disruptions, depending on who you are, what you call it. So I think it really instigated that kind of conversation for everybody to be able to stand up and go, actually, do you know what, I shouldn't be embarrassed. I shouldn't feel that I've done anything wrong, you know, within reason, obviously. And that's the key part of all of that work is bringing it into the public forum and
allowing people to have permission. There were two key things, Scott, because before we started the study, people were saying there's a 50% breakdown rate. I'm using that word breakdown because that's the word people were using at that point in time. Yeah. And we didn't find that. We found that adoptive parents went above and beyond what you could expect most people. You know, of anybody, they're sticking with extreme circumstances. And even when children were no longer able to stay with their adoptive family, they were, as you say, for the most part, parenting at a distance. That was the majority. I should be clear, though, that there were some families who were also abusive to their adopted children. You know, they were very much in the minority. There was maybe one or two that I can think of, but all the rest would, you know, were still paying for flats, doing their adult adoptees washing, looking after their adult child's own child. So there were also babies in the adopted families, you know, that were the next generation down. So there were two things that kind of rattled everybody: the low disruption rate, but we were also saying just because there's a low disruption rate doesn't mean that these families don't need support. Yeah. You know, and it was that was the important message from the study as well.
I recall it coming out and thinking, this feels like a sea change, and it feels like it's acknowledging all the anecdotal stuff that people were not saying. And I think for me, the one of the takeaways was that it was just that lots of families are really struggling and they're just keeping quiet about it, that they're just getting on with it. And even I think you sort of dug around and looked at how a lot of families don't even know the support available. They're just grinding it out. And so what was it like writing something that is like you sort of mentioned, that something that totally changed adoption culture? You know, there's a pre beyond the adoption order and there's a post, isn't there? Literally. I didn't know
it was going to do that. At the time, I wondered, is this even going to be published? Because if you look at the quotes that we've written, they are very powerful. You know, they're quite upsetting, some of the quotes. You know, our research would cry, you know, after doing an interview. Not obviously during the interview, but afterwards.
Of course not.
You know, I had a good team. But the distress that families were in also affected us as researchers. You don't listen to somebody's story like that and come away unaffected. So when we were writing it, we thought, we're going to put exactly down what families have told us, and we'll hope it's published, and we'll hope people pay attention, you know, because there are so many research reports, Al, and nobody pays any attention to them. So it was just that point in time where people were ready to hear, I suppose, as well.
Yeah.
You know, because as I say, you write so much research and it's, you know, it's in one ear, out the other, and we move on. So you say it was a sea change, but it's very hard to pinpoint why at that particular point in time it had that impact.
Because it was commissioned by the Department for Education, wasn't it?
It was.
So when you sort of finally, you know, with trepidation, you handed it in, you know, your big wadge of papers and sort of scuttled off. Was there any pressure from the Department for Education to sort of alter it or amend it or
none at all? They didn't interfere with the study at all. We'd also had advisory groups running through the study, so we'd been presenting some of the findings, you know, as we were going. But obviously, it doesn't have the same impact as everything put together in one place. So they were expecting something like this. But no, they didn't ask us to tone down any of the quotes, remove anything, nothing. It went as written.
I mean, I don't want to draw you onto the rocks of politics, but why the heck not? You can always not answer. Do you think that... I mean, I guess at that time, 2015, we had Michael Gove, who's an adopted adult. We had Edward Timpson, who sort of very altruistic, grown up in a home with an adopted sibling, with a foster child. Do you think it just sort of, it was just this alignment of all of these things that meant that it caught a wave or an emphasis that the government were looking for?
I honestly don't know. It's one of those key things, you know, why does research suddenly, maybe it was the power of the quotes, you know, maybe because it's, you know, if you don't read the statistics at the beginning and just read the interviews with the families, it's very readable because it's their stories through their lifetime. So it's a narrative. So it's an easy report to read from, you know, if you push the stats to one side. I don't know. Somebody else could probably answer it a lot better than me about why.
I mean, I think because I'm not worried about being political or anything, but there was also like a little bit of money in terms of adoption and special guardianship, because that was at the same similar time, not the same time, but a similar time of SGO investment. I know we're still a long way off that, but maybe it was all kind of within that kind of time as well. You know, the DfE were investing money in the future of children who literally can't live with their birth parents. So, you know, it could well have been just a coincidental time that those people were there. So,
outside of the Adoption Support Fund, I mean, your recommendations, I think there's one I was reading through it earlier, and it was talked about 60% of adopted parents had not kept in touch with their adoption agency or local authority, as it was then. Do you think if you were to go back and sort of do the Beyond the Adoption Order part two, just when you thought it was safe to go back to the academic bookshelf, what do you think? I mean, obviously, I know you're an academic, so you're not just going to guess. But go on, give me your best.
I think a lot more will have now. I think one of the other things that's changed. Not good enough yet by a long chalk, but I think now there's more of an expectation that adoptive families will stay in touch, or it's not just actually that adoptive families will stay in touch, it's that agencies have a responsibility for children that they're placing that they didn't have before. So although people used to say, oh, love is not enough and adoption needs support and we recognise all these things, it wasn't really there in practice. I think that's another thing that's changed, but adoption support still has a long way to go.
Thinking back to that time, I mean, there wasn't many adoption support teams back then, was there? You know, that is quite a new thing.
Yeah.
You know, you think about, well, I mean, I adopted in 2007 the first time. There was no such thing as an adoption team then. Adoption support team, should I say. And, you know, even 2014, 2015, some were still not quite there with that. So, you know, it was definitely a recognized as a new thing, and some were slower on the kind of development of that than others in terms of local
authorities. And some have really invested in skilling up their staff. You know, so there's more social workers now who know about DDP. But again, that's a wider shift in social work about becoming more trauma-informed in all areas of work, you know, in foster care and for guardians as well as doctors. So we're seeing that shift throughout practice.
Do you think that, because you're obviously quite involved in lots of academic stuff, but also quite practical system stuff as well. And do you think, where do you, obviously there's some really positive things have come out of Beyond the Adoption Order, but where do you see that the things that we need to be addressing now, what would I consider?
Gosh.
Yeah. Magic questions. If you had all the money in the world.
Oh, I know. These are always terrible questions. It's the sort of thing you get asked at interviews. If you had £1 million, what research would you do? You know, oh, gosh. There's so many things that need addressing. You know, this is in no particular order. Life story work. So there are still too many children being placed for adoption who have no idea what's happening in their lives. They just don't know even that they're being adopted, or that needs specific thinking about who should be doing that life story work. Because at the moment, it's children's social workers who have no time for it, who may not even know the child because they change so frequently, or it's given to a student social worker who comes into the office to do. They are so important for children's life. And again, it's not just adopted children, it's children in care as well. The other big project I work on is something called Bright Spots, which is about the well-being of children in the care system. And we know that it's something like 30% of 11 to 17 year olds have no idea why they're in care. You know, so it's
blimey.
Yeah.
That's
wow.
Yeah. You know, they don't understand why they're in care. If you look at the little ones, so our surveys are for 4 to 7s as well. It's about 50% of 4 to 7 year olds have no idea why they're in care. And they write things on the surveys like, if only I knew why I had a social worker, things would be better. So there's a lot of work about having some very difficult conversations sometimes with you know, especially if court cases haven't happened and you don't quite know what's going to happen. And ensuring that there's time and space to do that kind of work. Because we know if you don't understand where you've come from and why you are where you are, it has a big impact on your identity, on your self-esteem. And children they invent stories of why things have happened, and often they blame themselves. You know, thing I did that happened. So there's so much work around, you know, that needs doing around this area, life story work, and help children understand why they're in care. I should say some local authorities do it really well. You know, so it's we're not talking about every. It's very easy to sort of talk broad brush sometimes, but huge variation in practice, and there's some fantastic work that goes on, you know. And I'm really conscious that I don't be kind of rubbishing social work at the moment, because that's far from what I want to do. It's to do with pressures of work and workloads and all the other things that are on social workers, but it's an area, specific area, that needs looking at for all children who come into the care system.
It's a complicated conversation. I mean, I'm a social worker, registered social worker, and I have had social workers. But yeah, we're sort of removing what should be done from individuals, aren't we, in the sense that the criticism of the lack of support. And I know that, and I'm probably like you, and if I tweeted out, how's people's life story work going, that my smoke would come out the back of my phone for the next 12 hours solid, because it's such a... People feel underqualified, parents feel underqualified, they don't know where to start. They're often dealing with really complex information, and they, you know, they need someone to walk them through that.
And how to talk to their child about it, you know, because the doctors have said to me, how do I tell my child this story?
Yeah, it's so far outside of people's experience often. You know, I've got a friend who's, you know, he's had to sit down and tell his daughter that his father was a sexual sex offender.
Yeah.
And then go through a list of crimes, you know, and, you know, the poor man was just so beyond his lived experience and professional knowledge, you know. So just to chat with someone to help him do that. He felt responsible to do that, which is a good thing, but you just need a bigger, wiser person to talk to in those circumstances, don't you?
You do.
Sometimes.
You do. So that's one major thing. Another major thing is every family having a real support plan that's based on the individual needs of the child, not just tick boxes. You know?
Oh.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say, oh, that's a can of worms.
Is that a can of worms?
Well, I think...
Well, it is, isn't it? Because, I mean, these things are fine when they're placed, but actually they need reviewing.
Absolutely. You know,
6 months, 12 months, 5 years, whatever. And I think that's my biggest frustration is, you know, well, this is what you're going to need, and here's how you're going to do it. And then the needs are much greater, or there's new things that come up, or, you know, they settle, but, you know, and school becomes an issue, or health becomes an issue. And I'm not talking about right now, 2021. I'm talking about, you know, 2007 onwards. So it's a little bit, but, you know, even then, we've got adoption support teams now. Fantastic. We've got the ASF. Fantastic. Actually, a review of these support plans would be really useful. But there's very little in terms of resource and capacity to be able to review all children, you know. So, how, you know, it's... That's a difficult one, isn't it? But it's right. It should be there at the forefront of people's minds if they need support, that the review support plan should be reviewed.
But the support plan, for example, could include who you contact and how you contact if you need support, you know, because we still hear from adopters saying, I don't know where to go to get help. I don't know what I'm entitled to. I don't know what's available. The support plan could include signposts to various types of support, you know, the kind of typical things that many families need. But obviously there's always specialist needs as well for some families. But families sometimes say to me, all the support plan said was, register with a doctor, register with... You know, so that's what I meant about TICs, that it wasn't individualised for their child.
Can I ask a slightly related question to that? Because we've got under the 2004 Adoption Services, the duty of local authorities to do an assessment of adoption support needs.
Yeah.
And I think we all really get the idea that they just don't happen, particularly. And they've sort of been... Perhaps the Adoption Support Fund assessment has sort of maybe been merged into that. Do you think the 2004 regulations, or, you know, is it still relevant, or is it time for a refresh, or is there an appetite for that?
Now, you see, Al, you may know more than me here, because I thought that the adoption of support need was the same whether you're going for the ASF or any kind of adoption support.
Oh, now we're going to have to scratch our chins.
Awkward silence.
See, I didn't think it was a separate assessment. I thought it was the same one. But maybe you're right. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know about you, Scott. You probably know as he's just going off to clear his throat, aren't you, Scott?
I was actually, because I've been told by text not to mute myself when I have a little cough, because I've got a little cough tonight. Right. It's not COVID related, but I'm not allowed to mute my microphone. So I was just then off to go and stick my head out the door to have a little cough to myself. Anyway, go on.
Go and blow your tubes out.
I'll wait on my cough.
All right, good.
No, you're fine.
No, I've heard of people literally having, you know, local authorities hiring a room and people having 10 minutes with a social worker sat at a desk and people in a queue coming and doing their ASF assessment. Like a 10 minute.
I've heard of that as well. Yeah.
I've heard of people having to wait 18 months just to get on the list to do an assessment.
Yes.
And it is literally just going through the ASF plan, looking what you can get on the ASF. Mm. Now the ASF isn't.
Yeah.
When we talk about adoption support, that might be you just need a social worker to come and have a cup of tea and have a chat.
Mm. Mm.
The ASF doesn't provide that, does it?
No.
Well, hopefully it doesn't provide.
I think those were, from my knowledge of those, because I heard of them a good couple of years ago now, was they were classed as surgeries where you could just go along and share what your current issues were. And I think they were seen as a positive thing at the time. I know. I'm kind of cringing as I say that, but they were seen as a positive thing because it was designed to provide you with access to an official, like, you
to
know,
a social
professional
worker.
From the well, yeah,
that's terrible
because not a lot of people. I mean, I've literally always kept in touch with my social workers.
We're not normal,
my children. No, we're not, are we? We're really not. Actually, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's Justin. I don't know. But I've always kept in touch with them. And, you know, whether it was even after we'd had the adoption order granted, you know, I would go and have coffee with mine. In fact, I'm still friends with them, actually. Proper friends, Facebook friends with the social workers from those times. But it was, I mean, had I not had that, where would I have gone? Because I'm not sure that I would have went to a stranger and sat in a room and for 10 minutes. You know, so that makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, kind of that prospect. So, you know, they were, but they, at the time when they were first, I think they were seen as a kind of bridge to the kind of lack of adoption support, really. You know, let's provide these sessions. And I know one agency that I used to do some work for and they did them. And I thought at the time that they were quite a good idea. not so much now, but I think we've moved on. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't think there's so much, you know.
I don't know. But you know, some agencies were providing really good adoption supports even before the ASF.
Yeah.
You know, so again, what we see and what we still see is tremendous variation in practice across the country about what you get and when you get it. And that hasn't been resolved by of RAAs yet.
Yeah, it seems like some of those historic legacy issues have just merged into the new RAAs, but also some of those positives have come with them. And
yeah,
I mean, the RAA, what do you think generally about the move to RAAs? And, you know, has it been a positive? Do you think that this is the right thing to do? And are we seeing the fruit of that?
Well, I'm part of the evaluation team for the RAAs, and we haven't produced our final report yet. I can't really answer that yet because we haven't done all the analysis. But what the one thing I do see is that it's created a new group of leaders. So all the heads of the RAAs meet together as an RAA leaders group. And I think that is very positive for the sector because for the first time you've got a group of people with authority who are meeting to share ideas and move things forward, whereas in the past everybody was very isolated. So I think that's been a tremendous benefit. But I'm sure there's always pros and cons with lots of things, and I'm sure our report will talk about both bits.
When's the report due?
Summer.
Oh.
Like August, end of August. It probably, but then it has to go to an advisory group, and it will probably be out by October, I would have thought, September, October.
Now, the bad owl in my head, wants to say, give me a facial expression because it's a podcast that tells us whether it's good or bad. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to start sit on my hands and button my lip.
Because nothing is ever as simple as that, Al, anyway, is it?
Can't talk.
I was going to say, unusually, but I think because I did a lot of work with a lot of the RAs when they started to form with Adopt a Voice, and you know, we kind of contributed into that. That'll be a really interesting one to read, because again, I've heard positive stories. A load of the RAs are doing some fantastic work. They really, really are. Some of them were really slow to get started, and some are kind of catching up. And I think it's the catching up ones that will kind of create a little bit of those are the ones that will kind of create a little bit of what's called controversy in terms of, you know, how come the neighbouring RA can provide this and yet that one can't. But then that was the same with local authorities. But I think once they've caught up, it'll be a really positive. I generally think RAs are really positive longer term. You know, granted, we could have done like the ASF with, 10 pilots or whatever, but we didn't. So we just were stuck with what we had. But actually, having worked with a lot of these leaders, the project teams that were involved in them, and, you know, how open they were to involving the voices of everybody within that, who was relevant at that time. Some great work done there. So I'll be really interested to read that.
I mean, the other difficulty with the evaluation is it was done during COVID. So it's very difficult, what improvements RAAs have made when they've been setting up and operating during this period.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think the key point for me is the one you made at the beginning, which is that we've gone from 152 local authorities, 20 RA, 20 voluntary agencies. That's 170 heads of service down to a group of people you can put in one room. And if you're the Mint Children's Minister, you can rip a shred off them, or you can go in and exhort them to do better. Or that feels like you've got genuine influence over the whole system, whereas you never did have that, perhaps. Yeah. So that's good.
Yeah,
a good thing.
But they can also share best practice. It's not just about bad things, you know. So something that's being trialled in one RAA can, you know, the leaders talk about it.
That's fantastic. Could I take you back to a piece of, I didn't say I was going to do this, but you did some research 10 years ago in relation to matching and dilemmas in relation to ethnic matching in adoption. Is that something you're, I'm not going to catch you on the ropes here, am I?
No.
You've got an encyclopedic knowledge of everything you've done.
No.
It's something that seems to come round. I blame you, because I was somewhere and I heard you talk about it, so it piqued my interest and I went digging around. It's actually free on the internet. All of the stuff we reference we'll put in the show notes. I love the word show notes. It makes us feel like like we're on the telly. We're not. So you wrote some research in relation to ethnically matching and children of colour and adopters of colour. That seems to have come round again.
It does
seem to be. Yeah. Everything comes round in circles, doesn't it? So,
well, that's partly because of Black Lives Matters, you know. So that interest again has rippled across all sectors now,
which is great news.
Great news.
It feels like do you think that it fell off the agenda, or it became just? What do you think that was? Because it felt like it just sort of all went very quiet for a decade in the midst of, you know, all of the high-profile stuff. That stuff just wasn't present.
I don't know. Maybe it's because so few minority ethnic children are adopted, and the voice of adopters or the voice of minority ethnic adopters has been absent. It's primarily been driven by white adopters, so we haven't had that voice. They may be saying different things. I think. We need to look at our groups and think how diverse they are. And I think maybe the pressure was on trying to find families for the children who were waiting in the system, who were predominantly white. Nobody asked, well, should minority ethnic children have the same opportunities? It was almost as though adoption was not to be thought about, because then you had to deal maybe with some difficult issues about transracial adoption and whether we were only going to support same race or not. So it raised some difficult questions, and I think we ducked it.
All right. So those questions have perhaps come round again. And do you feel that we are willing to ask those questions now? Because the questions, you know, the adoption sort of the tip of the iceberg, isn't it? Because when you look beneath that, you then start to have to ask questions about the higher prevalence of certain ethnic groups within the care community. Is it? Mm-hmm. Are we willing to have that conversation yet?
Yeah, I think we are. Within the Adoption and Special Guardianship Leadership Board, sorry, that is such a mouthful, there is a new task group that is looking at diversity, which is led by the chair, Krish Kandia. So that's a group specifically looking at diversity and the issues of equity, really, and what's happening in the adoption system, both for children and adoptive parents. We've had more sort of academic reports coming out about the disparities in the care system, you know, about particularly, well, in the younger groups, there's a lot of mixed ethnicity children, and why that might be, and how we might best be able to find some form of permanence for all children. So
yeah.
those issues are back again on the agenda, and racial disparity is being discussed in all the forums I'm part of.
Yeah, it feels like it's a healthy time to have that conversation, and the answers are not necessarily comfortable, are they? But
no, they're not. Mm.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't ask the questions.
No.
I'm conscious we've used up a lot of your time. I think we've probably got time for maybe one massive question at the end.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So
there'll probably be a yes or no answer. We'll have a big build up, and it'll be yes or no.
I'll say it's 9 o'clock. I'm switching off.
Oh, I don't blame you.
Fair enough. Off the clock.
So with that in mind, then I'm going to ask it. Because obviously we've had a few years of this discussion about adoption, and with special guardians increasing, mm-hmm. kinship care, longer term fostering. Is adoption still going to be here in 30 years, do you think?
That is such a tough question. I think we'll continue to see growth in kinship care, in kinship. Mm. England has always had far fewer children in kinship care arrangements than other European countries. So, for example, in Spain, I can't remember the statistics, but it's something like 40% of children in the care system are with a relative. And that's because they pay relatives an allowance. There's a direct allowance paid which enables relatives to care for their child. And we're beginning to see some of that thinking now in England, where there's a transfer of the fostering allowance to relatives to allow them to care. And I think that's a good move, because we know that those placements are more stable than staying in foster care. When you look at the statistics, there's actually very few children who are in a long-term foster care placement. So many children have multiple placements. Relative care, definitely, yes. should be supported, and we should be promoting that. But there's always going to be some children who relatives, where there aren't any relatives able to care, or where there are so many siblings in a family that the relatives can't take any more. You know, we know that the families who come, where their children come into the care system often are much larger than families in the general population. I've read case files of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 children coming into care, all from one family. Now, a relative can't take them all, usually, not just housing problems, but just capacity and ability to cope. So I think we're always going to need adoption, but I think it will change. It will, as it's changed over the last 50 years, it will change. We'll see more adoptions with contact. I think we might see more adoptions combined with special guardianship, so that there's contact between the relatives and the adoptive parent if they're caring for siblings, so that we keep sibling contact going together. Mm. I think the nature of it will change. But I think there will always be some children who will need a new family. And what we need are the families out there who are willing to do that.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it makes you think that perhaps the adoptive parents will be different.
Yes, I think they will. Mm, I think they will. Mm.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. You used the word nature of adoption. I think that's really quite... Yeah, that to me makes sense, that the nature of adoption will change, and all the things that we know and we're talking about at the minute will develop into a more positive kind of experience for some of these young people who need to be in contact with their siblings or even their birth parents. That's a dream, really, isn't it? Within the context of
keeping safe,
why they've been adopted. Exactly. I think that's kind of my view on it, is exactly the same, that it may look different, but it potentially will still be here. So
and of course the role of social media.
Because even that's changed, hasn't it? I mean, I think about 2007, there was no such thing as social media. Then that changed later in 2007. I then started sitting on adoption panels a couple of years later, and that was the first thing that was mentioned, was social media. Social media, you need to be careful with social media. And now the message is still the same, you need to be careful, but it's a very different message, if that makes sense, because it's just generally acknowledged that the potential is there for it to happen.
Everybody uses it. Everybody deals with it. Social media. Mm-hmm. So that changes the whole nature of contact, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And we haven't really caught up with it.
No, I think that there's going to be a flipping where it's been the boogeyman.
Yeah.
But then I think that it's sort of flipping into a point where it's driving positive change, so that we're saying, well, actually, we need to have a better way of controlling contact, so that instead of just a letter once a year, we have a more positive, open system of contact.
Yeah, letterbox is terrible. It doesn't work.
Oh, it's the bane of everyone's life.
It doesn't work.
Well, Julie, that has been really interesting, and it would be lush to kind of get you back in 5 more years and kind of see where we're at and see where we're up to.
I'll be drawing attention then.
You'll not retire.
Oh, you could do it as a favour, I'm sure. Come on.
We'll come and get you.
It has been fascinating, actually. Really fascinating to talk to you about the kind of the background to it as well, and your own background as well, because not a lot of people will have known that. So that's okay. For sharing that.
And thank you for inviting me.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.